The Tom Woods Show, episode 676.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Is email driving you crazy and taking over your life? Do you feel like you can never possibly get and stay caught up? Well, here's my secret weapon. Sanebox.com/woods. That's SaneBox.com/woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're welcoming back Jonathan Haidt to the show. We talked to John Haidt some time ago about his book, The Righteous Mind, subtitle, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And that book will no doubt, at least in part, inform this conversation. But the reason I'm having him back is that I think of John Haidt as somebody who, you know, has his views like anybody else, but is, I don't want to say non-ideological, but he's somebody who is an old-fashioned academic in the sense that even though he may not be fully in our camp, so to speak, he's somebody who believes in fair play. He's somebody who believes in the open discussion of ideas, and he is somebody who is absolutely appalled at the violent suppression of dissident ideas, which is what we, in fact, are obviously seeing on university campuses. So I think he's an interesting person to talk to because he's not one of the firebrands whose talks are being shouted down, but he's a horrified observer who doesn't necessarily agree with the speakers themselves, but who thinks that it's totally unacceptable to act the way certain people, let's say, on campuses are acting. So I thought this would be a helpful conversation. A lot of people wrote to me about the last episode he was on. That was all the way back, episode 429. That episode was called, Is Reason Enough Why Your Opponents Won't Listen? A lot of people got a lot out of that episode, and I hope you'll get a lot out of this episode too. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist and the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership at NYU's Stern School of Business. He taught for 16 years at the University of Virginia before that. His three TED Talks have been viewed more than 3 million times. He holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Yale and his PhD in psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. Foreign Policy magazine named him one of the top global thinkers, and Prospect magazine named him one of the top world thinkers, and he's here to chat with us today once again. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be back.
I've had many, many requests to have you back, and I think my listeners think I'm just not listening to them, but we've both been busy, and it's been hard to make this happen, but here we are. We're going to make the most of it. What they want to talk about in particular is that you've been talking about a topic that is of great interest to a lot of people who listen to the show, and that is what's been going on the campuses. And what's interesting about your perspective is that you come at this as somebody who, well, at least what we established on the show last time was that you began, I think, as somebody with some, you know, reasonably well-formed ideological views. But then as you began researching different peoples and groups and points of view, you began to say to yourself, well, it doesn't mean I have to agree with everybody, but I can at least get inside the minds of these people. I can at least understand why they think the way they do. They're not subhuman. They're not a different species. We just have disagreements. And I respect that because it's so rare to come across somebody like that. Now, what I want to ask you is, when we're looking at the campuses, though, can you make a blanket statement here? I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you make a statement that there are people of certain ideologies who are more likely to cause a campus ruckus than others? I mean, yes, I am looking to score points here. I'll be honest with you.
Oh yeah, no, it's very, very clear that it's a relatively small group. It's on the left. It's what's commonly called social justice activists or social justice warriors, and we can get into why that is. I mean, you know, the history is full of extremist right-wing movements, extremist left-wing movements, but the fact that universities have switched from leaning left throughout the 20th century to being almost entirely on the left between the late 1990s and about 2010. We had as the greatest generation retired, a lot of them were Republicans. They were replaced by baby boomers. So the makeup of the faculty, especially in the humanities and social sciences, went from about, you know, 3-to-1, let's say, left-right ratio to about 10-to-1 or 15-to-1 in most departments. So in this particular case, it is a a group that is on the left. But I'm not saying that I'm not saying the left is more closed-minded than the right in general, just in this case, because of the universities concentrating. And the key thing to keep in mind, don't call them liberal. That's the key thing everybody needs to focus on. What we're seeing is an explosion of illiberalism. Progressives can be liberal or illiberal. Conservatives can be liberal or illiberal. Liberal means freedom, liberty. You believe in free expression, free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association. And what we're suffering from is an explosion of illiberalism from certain groups of students, really primarily students more than faculty on the left.
I had a political scientist on the show toward the end of last year, April Kelly Wessner of Elizabethtown College.
And she's a member of Heterodox Academy. Yes.
Oh, of course. So you know each other. Okay.
Yes.
Well, because she had an interesting conclusion, because we're inclined to think that the so-called millennials are the most tolerant people who ever walked the earth. But she says, well, if you define tolerant in the way that most of us would define tolerant, not just that you accept a lot of different lifestyles, but that how you treat people you disagree with and how you conceive of people you disagree with, they may be the least tolerant people we've seen in a long time. Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, no, I think April has done some great writing on our site, on Heterodox Academy. I think she is correct. So here's what I would add as a social psychologist. So as we talked about last time in my book, The Righteous Mind, I analyze morality. And one of the principles is morality binds and blinds. So look at any movement. What do they hold sacred? Always start by asking, what do they hold sacred? And around that, you'll find a ring of motivated ignorance. So millennials today have been raised with the central virtues are inclusion. Diversity and inclusion are very important virtues. So this is all great. I don't want to pick on millennials. The problems that we're talking about are problems caused by the things that my generation and the baby boomers did to them. So this is not a blame game. It's just saying that they were raised with this incredible mandate for tolerance and inclusion of people of different races, different sexual orientations. So that's all great. I'm all in favor of a more inclusive world, more inclusive campuses that don't make people feel unwelcome. So that's all great. I totally agree with the goal. But what happens is, as Aristotle told us, any virtue carried to extremes becomes a vice. And if you make inclusion of people who are different, if you make that your absolute sacred virtue, and then you have a professor, let's say, who gives a lecture on how, well, actually, you know, gender differences are real, and maybe that contributes to the wage gap. Well, suddenly you're going to get people, what? Are you saying that women deserve to be paid less? And so you can't say such things. You can't say anything on campus that will make any member of one of the seven protected groups feel uncomfortable. So I think April is exactly right that this extreme value placed on inclusion and diversity has led them to be extremely intolerant of anyone who says anything that's taken to be uncomfortable for a member of a protected group.
Let's talk about some of these. I don't know where the term social justice warrior came from. I don't want to use that term, but unfortunately, it's out there. And
social justice activist, I think, is a better term.
Yeah, activist. But yeah, even that I think is too kind. I think the other one is too loaded in another way. But anyway, whatever. We all know the group of people we're talking about. Based on what you argue in your book, and maybe you could remind us a little bit about how it is that people come to be persuaded of things and how it is that they don't come to be persuaded of things. Is it possible for somebody like me, who is a libertarian, ever to reach them, for us to sit down and hash things out, or are we basically sealed off from each other forever?
Mm-hmm. Well, ever is a big word. So if you were to try it 100 times, you, Tom, with your gifts of eloquence and persuasion, you would probably be successful at least 5 times out of 100, and that is pretty good. So I would never say never. But I'd like to look at this in a more sociological way, that we hold our beliefs for many, many reasons. To some extent, we believe they're true. To some extent, we are displaying our virtues. To some extent, we are displaying our tribal membership, the way a gang member wears a red or a blue handkerchief or shirt, something like that. So depending on a person's motives for holding a belief, you will be more or less successful. There's a wonderful quote from one of the Russian novelists. I don't know if it's Tolstoy or which. Something like, it's very difficult to persuade a man of something if his salary depends on him not understanding it.
I always loved that.
So, there are many beliefs that are so central, so foundational, that if you tried to argue against that. Well, actually, what we see on campus, we see students saying that this would invalidate their existence. So if you were to try to argue that some cause of prejudice or racism was not real, or that disparities by race or gender had other causes, some would take this as an existential threat, an existential attack. You would be trying to invalidate their existence, which is an act of violence. So your very efforts to persuade with reasons are violence.
So because they look at it that way, they come to think of a debate, an open debate and free speech, as being these terms that sound neutral and sound like they're just advocating openness, but that actually the very fact that we're debating it means that we're denying their right to exist. Am I kind of getting it?
Yes, that's correct. And when I've had conversations like this with some groups of those students, I've been told that these norms of debate and civility, these were invented by white males, white European males. So what's interesting about the way discourse has changed, I think it's actually quite dangerous for free inquiry and for universities, and April has written brilliantly on this. The way it's changed is that certain norms that grow out of the Marxist tradition have been established on campus. And so one of them is what you might call the ad hominem albus argument. I just looked this up this morning. Albus is the Latin word for white. So, you know, we all know what an ad hominem argument is. It's not a valid form of argument. You reject, rather than arguing against what someone said, you say, yeah, well, you know, you're Jewish, therefore, or, you know, you're gay or whatever, so therefore I don't have to listen to you. And so what students are taught in many of their classes is start with an analysis of privilege. So who's the speaker? What are the speaker's motives? Is the speaker just defending his privilege? And so since it's often, this is literally most of the arguments I've gotten, most of the counter arguments, literally since I started this last August with my Atlantic article with Greg Lukianoff, we've been scouring the internet. We've been looking for people arguing back. We've been looking for reasons why we might be wrong. What have we missed? And I kid you not, more than half of the arguments, and I'm talking like a total of maybe 6 blog posts, like nobody's really argued back, but most of them are basically, well, they're white males. They're just defending their privilege. And so that's what I call the ad hominem albus argument. And if students learn to start every analysis with a privilege check and to dismiss arguments made by the privileged people and to emphasize arguments made by the victim people, they have more authenticity, they have more valid life experience. Well, if this is what they're learning in college, where basically, I mean, we're teaching them to judge everybody by their race and sex? Are you serious? This is really what we're doing? Yes, this is what we are doing on campus. And so it's no surprise then that you cannot argue them out of a position. I'm not saying they could argue us out of a position. I'm not saying we're more rational. But at least, you know, you and I come from a tradition where if someone gives you an argument, you at least address yourself to the argument, not to the person.
Now, I know this isn't a place you want to go, but I'll just simply say for them to complain this much that they're dealing with Europeans who are just protecting, you know, defending their privilege. I would say that in Western societies, they have been treated with more indulgence than they would have been treated in any pre-modern or non-European society anywhere on the face of the earth, which would, I think, have had a much more summary way of dealing with disruptions like this. They should be glad they live in a society that values open debate, because the only substitute for open debate is force. That is the substitute. So how do we then pull them out of the idea that we look at somebody and by looking at them, we can automatically assume what that person is thinking, what his motivations are, and whether I can ever be an ally of that person? How do we change that? Is that changeable?
Yeah. So in general, direct routes to persuasion are difficult. I don't think this is a problem that we solve by directly trying to persuade people. Now, let me make clear, I want to say this over and over again. This is not an indictment of all millennials. Most students on campus are not like this. And we're only talking about elite residential colleges. So, most students go to a vocational school, a community college, a non-residential school. That they are not infected with this way of thinking. This is our elite schools in which students come, they live on campus. All the professors are on the left. All of the smart and cool people are on the left. And they're immersed in this world for 4 years. These ideas come especially out of the humanities. So those who are majoring in the natural sciences are not as much touched by this. So again, this is not an indictment of most young people, but it is a small group of the illiberal left that everyone's afraid of. So this relatively small group on each campus has everyone cowed. The students are afraid of them. The professors are afraid of them. They have outsized influence. So once you look at it that way, then you say, well, what can we do so that in the future, the number of people in this group will be smaller and less influential? So here are a couple of suggestions. One, as I wrote in a Wall Street Journal editorial op-ed with Lee Jessen, we looked into the research on what leads to feelings of marginalization, and one of them was having a lot of ethnic enclaves. That is, when you have a lot of women's studies centers, African studies centers, Latino studies, when you have all those groups, those tend to heighten the sense of racial separateness and grievance. The protesters all over the country are demanding more of them, and the university administrators are giving in. That's going to make things worse. So if a university were serious about restoring free inquiry and eliminating the intimidation factor of this small group of students, they would gradually try to phase out all the different enclaves. Now, you can keep the courses. It's when you have a whole department devoted to grievance. That's when you get a real cultural problem. Second, I would change admission standards. Don't keep rewarding students for writing about how they challenged this, they were social justice activists on that, they protested this. Why don't you reward people or say, tell me about a time when you dealt with someone who thought differently than you. How did you deal with that? Were you ever able to understand a different perspective? So if we admit for social justice activism, we get social justice activists. If we admit for viewpoint diversity or the ability to live with viewpoint diversity, we'll get students that are able to deal with viewpoint diversity. Boy, there are lots of other things that we can do. And my hope is that there will be a couple of schools among the top 50. A couple will realize that most of the country is disgusted by what the universities are doing to cave into this small group of activists. That a couple, I'm hoping that the University of Virginia and the University of Chicago, that have long free speech traditions, that their students will vote to declare themselves a dangerous school rather than a safe school. A dangerous school is one that does not try to protect students from words and ideas, and a safe school is one that does. So I'm hopeful that the students themselves at some schools will rise up and say, enough, enough. We're tired of this small group intimidating everyone into silence. We want to change things.
You know, while on the one hand, we all know that not a lot of university administrators are going to wind up in the second edition of Profiles in Courage, but on the other hand, they at the same time have to know that the first administrator who steps forward and says, you know what, this is not happening on my campus, mm-hmm. you're going to sit down and study like everybody else and stop intimidating everybody on campus, not only would that person be an instant celebrity, but applications to that school would pour in from bright students all over the country who just don't want to be intimidated. Why do we still not see one person doing that?
Oh, no, we have. So
I want to hear it then. Tell me.
Oh, the president of Ohio State. This is just fantastic. So the president of Ohio State, it was like about a month ago. Let's see. What's his name? Just looking it up online here. At any rate, if you just Google Ohio State student protesters, so when they came storming into his office and issued their ultimatum to him, he refused to meet with them. He sent out a deputy who said, he'd be very happy to meet with you if you schedule an appointment, but he's not going to accept an ultimatum. And when you stormed in here, you made everyone who works here feel unsafe.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So he turned their logic against them.
Yeah.
And he said, they're going to come back to work tomorrow at 8 a.m. And if you are still here, then you will be arrested. We will give you a chance to go to jail for your beliefs. And it worked like a charm. So let's see. What is his name? I need to find his name to... Jay Casey. There we are. Ohio State... Oh, the vice president. The vice president, Jay Casey, is the one who came out and read them the Riot Act. And he said, Dr. Drake will never receive a list of demands, and he will not negotiate with you. So I think what's happening here is that pretty much all the presidents last fall caved in. They had a mob on their doorstep. They felt that pressure. But did they hear an earful from the alumni, from trustees, and I think from some students and faculty on campus who are afraid to speak up publicly but who spoke to him privately. So now they're realizing that if you cave in, you're a laughing stock and everyone outside campus will make fun of you. And if you stand up, you'll actually get a lot of support. So that's why I think the tide is going to turn. I think next fall, things are going to look a lot different. This hit us all by surprise last fall. But I think the great majority are bothered. The great majority of people on the left are bothered by the illiberalism. And I think we're going to see a much more unified front in standing up to them next fall.
John, let's take just a quick minute to thank our sponsor. Folks, if you're like me, you're buried in email and you're pleading for help. You don't know what to do about it. It's interfering with your mental health and your life and your peace of mind, and you don't know what to do about it. Well, the answer is SaneBox. I use it myself. I swear by it. It sorts my email. It makes sure that I see the important stuff and that I can see the unimportant stuff on my own time when I get around to it. I can tell it to resend me emails in a couple of days when I'm ready to deal with them, so that by the end of the day, I have one way or another dealt with all my email every single day. You need this for your mental health. You need it for your productivity. You need it for efficiency. So check it out at SaneBox. That's SaneBox, SaneBox.com/woods, and get a free trial. And then when you do what I did, which is when your free trial runs out, you immediately rush to throw money at them because you've got to have this service. You automatically get a $25 off credit as a Tom Woods Show listener. Got to use that link, SaneBox.com/woods. All right. Now, as somebody who has written about different ideologies, do you think there's a reason? Is it that some ideologies lend themselves more to illiberalism, or is it just that at this particular moment in time, we're just experiencing one having a particularly illiberal moment? Because I just remember back from my day, and I was an undergrad from 90 to 94, and it was a left-ish – it was basically an establishment-slash-left sort of campus, and we had – almost every speaker was centered to left. You'd get maybe one slightly right – you know, you'd get a Bob Dole who would put the whole campus to sleep. That would be the bone they would throw. But we never disrupted anybody, and in fact, it's not like we said, well – maybe we should disrupt them, but on second thought, we wouldn't. The thought never occurred to us in the first place, and I am actually not familiar with a left-wing speaker in the past, let's say, 20 years coming to try to speak and being driven off by right-wing students. Are you aware of an episode like that?
No, that doesn't happen. So there's a big asymmetry. When Bernie Sanders spoke at Liberty University, you know, all the students didn't like what he had to say, but they were polite. Nobody was protesting or booing him or trying to shut him down. So you're absolutely right that there's a big asymmetry, and you only find left-wing protesters shutting down speakers who are right of center, and often even left of center if they're not completely orthodox to their liking. But I'm not sure that I would jump to saying, well, this is just a product of left versus right wing minds. This is what you get when you get almost no academic or intellectual or political diversity. And so since even right-wing schools, like when I've spoken at military academies and things like that, the faculty usually are about a third to a half on the left. So and even I would bet, even at Christian schools, even at schools that are evangelical, I would bet that a lot of the faculty are even still going to be left to center. So there is no analog to a right-wing school where every professor is not just on the right, but on the far right. If you could imagine one, if there was one that was really, really far right, and everybody was far right, and everybody was fired up about their righteousness, and then you invited Bernie Sanders, well, maybe then, you know, he'd get a similar treatment. So we can't really run the thought experiment because such a school simply doesn't exist. But in the present climate, yes, students are routinely disrupting anyone they don't like. And so this is another thing that must happen that every school can do beginning next fall. Have an absolute rule. Go ahead and protest. Hold up signs. Ask hostile questions. The minute you take it upon yourself to shut down the event, the minute you and your allies take it upon yourselves to decide what your fellow students get to hear and what they don't, you are expelled. This is as antithetical to the mission of a university as could be. This must become the greatest taboo, the greatest sin on campus, is to shut down those who disagree with you. That's one change I would urge on every campus in America.
Do you have any interest in becoming a university president?
Oh, my God. I would much rather have dental surgery for the rest of my life.
Just because it's nothing but headaches?
Oh, well, look, it's an incredibly political position. So, you know, anytime you hear that lots of people in a position are bad people, you pretty much know it's not that they're bad people. It's the demands of that job turn good people into that sort of spineless, you know, whatever you want to say about them. So, you know, I mean, I know Peter Salib. He's a very nice guy. He was actually my TA as an undergrad at Yale. He's the president of Yale now. So, look, Peter is a very nice guy. He speaks very well about free speech. He's got good values. But yet when he was faced with the political pressures of angry students who were protesting and wanted him to fire Erica and Nicholas Christakis, while he didn't fire them, but he never condemned them or the student who was screaming obscenities at them. He never did a thing that would anger those students. So he caved into them. He validated their view that Yale is hopelessly racist. He caved. Now, you know, he's a good guy and he has good values, but he was in a very difficult situation and he failed to rise to the occasion. I think we're going to see many more, as I said, we'll see many more presidents rising to the occasion now, but it was very tough for all of them last fall.
Can you believe it's gotten to the point where Harvard is discontinuing the use of the term house master to refer to the faculty member who lives in each of the upper class houses, because master sounds like the master-slave relationship, when of course it comes from magister, the Latin?
Well, yeah, but you know, look, there's certain changes that I think that I'm much more willing to go along with. That one isn't dishonest. That one doesn't subvert the principle.
It's not dishonest, but come on, it's stupid. I mean, really, is there really somebody who can't get good grades because the word master is being used? I mean, honestly, I'd like to meet that person.
Yeah, you know, I think there is a need to listen to Black students and gay students and all the other groups that have. There's a need to listen, and where accommodations can be made. I, you know, these are all difficult things, and I'm not opposed to making some. So, for example, I, you know, as I said, I went to Yale. One of the colleges is called Calhoun. Now, I'm strongly against pulling down statues and paintings and things like that, you know, because this is history. And if we start doing that, if everybody has a veto, you know, then there's nothing left. But, you know, a residential college is something you're supposed to be proud of, you identify with. It's not like just there's a statue on campus and therefore we're going to destroy it. So I'm actually, you know, if there was a procedure in place and if the students and if everybody was, you know, 2/3 in agreement over the course of a couple of years, I'm not averse to renaming some things. But it's that the fact that this is done by intimidation and threat, that to me is an absolute, absolute no. And anytime these changes are demanded by ultimatum, anytime students get their way by intimidation, not by reason or argument, which is what's happening now, the intimidation, that's when we all need to stand up and say, no, this is, you do not do this. And if you do it again, you're out.
You've mentioned a couple times Heterodox Academy, which is heterodoxacademy.org. Can you tell people what that's all about, how it got started?
Yeah, so I actually got into this whole line of work in 2011 when I was asked to give a talk at the main conference of social psychologists, and the president of the organization invited me, and I said, well, I would speak on the future of social psychology and how we have no diversity and this is damaging our science. And he said, great, go right ahead. So Todd Heatherton, very open-minded guy, wonderful president of the organization. So I gave this talk and I presented data on how one-sided we had been and how it affected our scholarship. And the field actually reacted pretty well. And that led to five other social psychologists joining with me to write up a more formal paper. That paper came out last September. And we knew that when the paper came out, there'd be some discussion of it, and then it would fade into oblivion. We didn't want that to happen. So in September, we launched a website called heterodoxacademy.org because we found that the same problem, the complete loss of political diversity, affected sociology, law, and many other fields in the social sciences and the academy. So we didn't know that this was all going to blow up. We just launched the site in September, hoping to make a sustained case that while diversity is important, the most important kind of diversity is viewpoint diversity. You have to have people who think differently. You have to make room for them to speak up. And that's what we've been losing as we've been focusing on race and gender and other kinds of demographic diversity. So we put up the site in September, and then all hell broke loose at Halloween at Yale and other places. And campuses have been in intellectual lockdown, in a sense, since then. So we've emerged as the major site at which professors who are concerned about what's going on can come. We have 28 so far. We're about to open up the membership to everybody who wants to join, who's a professor. And we are making the sustained case that the academy cannot function unless it takes seriously the need for viewpoint diversity, and it starts working to promote that. So I urge all your listeners, go to heterodoxacademy.org. We've got lots of great essays, lots of resources to understand what's happening, and to arm yourself to argue back, to to understand what's happening, like with April's essays, and understand what's happening and how do you respond when people say various things that are really quite poorly reasoned.
I also want to remind people about your, again, we've mentioned it a couple of times, your book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. Because as I told you, that episode, when last time you were on, where we talked about your book and the way, you know, the way people's minds are changed, I got a huge amount of feedback from people. They listened to the episode and or they read the book, and they said it really did change the way they approached other people, because, you know, we're inclined to think, I have an engineer's mind, and I think, well, if I just hit these certain bullet points, that ought to do it, you know, which is really bad, by the way, with relationships. You think, well, if I want to learn intimacy, if I can master the following 7 things, that is exactly the wrong. It's the difference between painting by number and actually just doing a painting.
Yeah, that's right. Honey, let me explain to you the 7 reasons why you're wrong and I'm right. Yeah, that's not gonna
exactly. And I've divided them into subcategories as well, and I've tagged them. You know, forget it. Yeah. So I definitely want to do that. So we're going to link to that at, let's see, this will run on, I don't even know what episode number this is. Episode 672. Hold on a minute.
Okay.
Hold on. Wait, let's figure out what episode number this is. So let's see. 672 was it. Then 673, 45. Okay, we're going to say this is episode 676. I have no idea when this is going to be, but it'll be sometime in the next few days. I'll link to your book. I'll link to heterodoxacademy.org. Do you still use the Righteous Mind website that you have, righteousmind.com?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So, I would recommend that people go to righteousmind.com. There's a lot of materials there for understanding moral psychology. I think that moral psychology is almost like one of those things you could buy in the back of a comic book when you were a kid, at least when you and I were kids. You know, that things would give you special magical powers to see things or to control people. Studying moral psychology has felt to me like studying the operating system of the human mind and of human relationships. I know that a lot of political operatives seem to like the book, unfortunately, to use for nefarious reasons. But I urge all of your listeners to use moral psychology to get along better with others, to understand how they tick, to understand how groups and social movements form, and to understand how to persuade people with indirect means.
And with that, I will say thank you once again for your time. It's much appreciated. And I hope people check out all the Jonathan Haidt-related resources at tomwoods.com/676. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Tom. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody, that'll do it. Let me tell you about what's going on this week. Let's see, although I guess I'm going to be talking to the guy at the end of the week, so this will come up next week. But we're going to do an episode on anti-discrimination law and public accommodation, and we're going to do it with Ryan McMakin, who has an article on this that blew my mind because it raised all kinds of historical issues that I hadn't known about or thought about, and that really gives us a richer understanding of that whole question, which is a real challenge for libertarians. So that's coming up. A couple weeks from now, don't forget, we're going to be doing, and of course you may not know the date that I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you on June 7th, 2016. A couple weeks from now, we've got that debate coming up between Vox Day and Bob Murphy on free trade. You will hear it here, and it's going to be super great and informative and tough and fun and interesting. So that's coming up. This week, Brian McClanahan's going to come back on the show. He's a historian, of course. You can get his free course on the presidents, the U.S. presidents, and their crimes against liberty over at freehistorycourse.com. I strongly urge you to check out freehistorycourse.com. Keith Preston's coming back on the show. I love uncategorizable people like Keith Preston and Bill Kaufman. Can't pigeonhole these people at all. But Keith has a new book out, again, that is extremely thought-provoking, has to do with political correctness, and he's coming at this not as a traditional conservative or libertarian, but as a guy you're going to really, really enjoy listening to. And I'm thinking of doing some kind of a, I don't know if I should do a roundtable discussion or something on the Libertarian Party, because I do want to represent a variety of perspectives on this. I don't always want to do that, by the way. It is my show, and if I want only my perspective, then doggone it, that's what's going to happen. But sometimes I do want to have let's get a variety of perspectives, and let's hash it out and talk about it. So I may do that. I'm right now, as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking of several people I think would be good to bring on to talk about the Libertarian Party. And I wonder, I don't want to outnumber the one, you know, I don't want there to be one guy who's making a you know, an argument against mine, then everybody else is ganging up on him. I got to think of a couple of people. So let me hash this out. But I want to do this. I want to have a roundtable about what's going on in the Libertarian Party. All right. FreeHistoryCourse.com. Go grab that free history course, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.